nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
University of California in Irvine. Jason just has been doing condensed matter theory since undergrad. It was a Leroy Apker award when he was an undergrad student. He was in Florida where he graduated in 2001. Then he went to a grad school in UC Santa Barbara and worked with Matthew Fisher, graduated in 2007. And then he did a postdoc in Caltech for 3 years, and he joined faculty at UC Irvine just in 2010. And in recent years, he has worked pretty actively in various areas, particularly such as topological quantum states. And today, he'll talk how to make graphene into one.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Yang, for that kind introduction. And thanks so much for the invitation to be here. It's my first time at Purdue, and it's been a really fabulous visit, so thank you for having me. The goal of my talk is going to be to describe how one can take one of the most readily available two-dimensional systems that we have, namely graphene, and try to turn it into a quite exotic phase of matter called a topological insulator that you can actually have a good chance of seeing experimentally. So that's what I hope to convince you of here. The way in which I'm going to do this may sound initially somewhat counterintuitive. I'm actually going to intentionally disorder graphene in a certain way. I'm going to take certain kinds of ad atoms and just drop them randomly into the graphene sheet. And the hope is that those ad atoms modify the electronic properties of graphene in a suitable way to drive you into this topological insulator phase of matter. So before I go any further, let me just acknowledge my collaborators on this work. I had the pleasure of working with Marcel Franz from UBC and his grad student Conan Weeks, as well as my colleague Ruchan Wu from UCI and his postdoc Junhu. So Jun and Ruchan are the people who are responsible for all the density functional theory results, which I'll show you here. Let me also briefly just acknowledge useful conversations with many people who lent helpful insights into this work, as well as funding from the NSF. All right, so here's a quick outline for what I hope to cover in the talk. I'm going to start by giving a brief introduction to 2D topological insulators, assuming that no previous knowledge about the subject. I hope to convey what's interesting about these systems and why it's worth doing what I'm going to try to do in the talk. Then I'm going to comment on the status of graphene as a topological insulator material. After that, I'm going to describe our approach for using ad atoms to drive this phase of matter in graphene. And finally, I'll finish by highlighting some challenges and I'll provide a brief outlook and some future directions that we hope to explore. Okay, so now let me start by reviewing what a 2D topological insulator is. So I think it's simplest to start with a primer. Let me back off from experiment momentarily and just consider a very interesting toy model that was introduced by Haldane some time ago for quote-unquote spinless graphene. Okay, so for the moment, let's imagine that somehow we artificially strip away the spin degree of freedom from the electrons in graphene, and what I then get is just spinless fermions hopping around on the honeycomb lattice. Okay, so the honeycomb lattice, let me just remind you, consists of two inequivalent sublattices. There's an A sublattice, which I'm coloring blue here, and a B sublattice, which I color red. And let me, for concreteness, define operators CAK dagger and CBK dagger, which just add spinless fermions with momentum K to either the A or B sublattice. Now, the simplest Hamiltonian that you would initially be tempted to consider for this system just allows those fermions to hop between nearest neighbor sites of the graphene sheet. Okay? So that nearest neighbor tunneling only couples blue to red sites and red sites to blue sites. So the Hamiltonian that you obtain it just has this 2x2 matrix structure, which has purely off-diagonal matrix elements. Okay? So this CK simply encodes the nearest neighbor tunneling matrix elements for this nearest neighbor hopping problem. Okay, so if you solve for the eigenvalues of this 2x2 matrix, that gives you the band energies, and those have this now famous band structure shown here, which supports two massless Dirac cones at the inequivalent points of the Brillouin zone, at the Brillouin zone corners. Okay, now if your system is at half filling, what you'll do in the ground state is you'll fill up all the states below this Dirac point, and everything above will be empty. So your system is not quite an insulator because there's no gap in the spectrum, but it's not quite an ordinary metal either because the Fermi surface is just consists of two discrete points. So instead, what one usually refers to this system as realizing is a semi-metal. Right? So this is old stuff. So Haldane, way back in 1988, so he was actually quite ahead of his time in this field, which I guess he kind of always is. But back in 1988, Haldane decided to introduce another term in this Hamiltonian, a very particular term, which allows electrons, or these spinless fermions, to hop between second neighbor sites of the honeycomb lattice. And in particular, the second neighbor hopping was taken to be purely imaginary. Okay? So what I mean by that, if let's say, if a fermion hops along the arrows, in this diagram, there's a phase factor of plus I associated with that hopping process, whereas if the fermions move against those arrows, there's a phase factor of minus I introduced. Yeah.
Can I ask that you're actually hopping just as a little magnet field flux?
Well, the total flux here is zero.
But you have modulating phosphorus.
That's right, yeah. So you can think about it that way. That's right.
So this is coping in the absence of magnetic field.
That's right, yeah.
How it breaks time reversal symmetry?
How does it break time reversal symmetry?
Yeah, so why it is breaking time reversal symmetry?
Well, because there's a chirality associated with these hoppings, right? There's a preferred orientation, and so you'll basically get staggered currents here, right? It's basically, you know, on a more formal level, there's complex numbers in the Hamiltonian, and for spinless fermions, time reversal basically just introduces complex conjugation.
Why does the tunnel, in what way it is broken? It tunnels, you draw arrow in one direction, why there is no reverse arrow?
That's exactly the point. So I've decided to draw a particular orientation of these arrows. So if I were to reverse the arrows, I'd get a different Hamiltonian, which is actually related to the one I've written down here by time reversal symmetry.
You mean that if you actually take into account that there is also tunneling in reverse direction, it would be...
There is tunneling in both directions.
There is.
Yeah, so fermions don't just hop along these arrows. It's the phase factor associated with a fermion moving along those arrows, which is different from the phase factor that they get if they move in the opposite direction. So it's
a different phase factor?
Because it's an imaginary hopping term, right? So if you have something like I, C, I, dagger, C, J, plus Hermitian conjugate, you know, the C, I, dagger, C, J has a plus I corresponding to, you know, a particle moving in one direction, and the Hermitian conjugate term has the opposite phase factor. Just hermicity.
What is the factor that physically breaks time reversal symmetry?
Well, this is a toy problem. This is a totally off in theory land. So, you shouldn't attach too much meaning to what actually generates this yet, right? I'm just writing this down as Haldane did quite some time ago. So I'm going to make things more realistic in a moment. So, and I think hopefully the confusion will be alleviated then. Is that okay? So this is just you know, by fiat, I just write down these terms, okay? And, you know, this is perfectly good Hamiltonian. It's Hermitian. It breaks time reversal symmetry because if you complex conjugate this, you get a different Hamiltonian, okay? Is that okay? Where this comes from is kind of not a very meaningful question because I have spinless fermions in the first place, right? And it's not very meaningful to think about, you know, physical origin of these sort of processes for spinless fermions. I mean, the notion of time reversal symmetry is completely different for spinful versus spinless fermions.
So basically, you know, if to write this, indeed, this term on the diagonal, mm-hmm. it will break time reversal symmetry.
That's right, yeah.
But of course, you have, so as you know, graphene has two points, which is K and K prime.
Yeah.
And if you would write the same Hamiltonian for K prime point, the signs on the Hamiltonian would be exactly reversed.
So this is not a Hamiltonian just valid near K. This is a sum over all momenta in the Brillouin zone. Right? So this is not an effective Hamiltonian for the Dirac points. This is the microscopic tight binding model that you get here. So the K and K prime are encoded here. And you're right that MK at the K point is one sign, and MK at the opposite K prime point has the opposite sign.
So the same at the K prime point?
No, it has opposite. So this Hamiltonian is the same. Well, it's the same Hamiltonian, but MK, if I evaluate K at, okay, there's confusion with K's, and I'm using momentum K here. Let me call it maybe Q, just to distinguish from K and K prime. Yeah, so M at Q equals K. Okay, one Dirac point has a particular sign, and if I evaluate MQ at the K prime point, that has the opposite sign. Has the opposite sign.
And then there is a time reversal symmetry in this way.
No, there's no time reversal symmetry here. There's no sense, there's never a sense of time reversal symmetry here. Yeah, in no sense is there a time reversal. Yeah, so you can take my word for it, or we can actually. It'll probably become more obvious why there's no time reversal symmetry if you just in a couple of slides.
We'll see from the state what is the time reversal operator, and then.
So time reversal, it's just complex conjugation.
That's what I'm saying.
It's just complex conjugation. That's what I tried to. And if you complex conjugate, it just reverses all these arrows here, and you get a different Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
So in no sense is there time reversal symmetry here. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So let me move on, and hopefully this will become clear in a minute. Okay, so now I got a new Hamiltonian, which now has actually diagonal matrix elements because these second neighbor hoppings couple the same sublattices, okay? And it has this this structure where it's MK along for the A sublattice and minus MK for the B sublattice. Okay, so I have a new 2x2 Hamiltonian, which I'd now like to solve. Oh, but okay, I forgot to emphasize this point, which is probably obvious by now, but in fact, this Hamiltonian breaks time reversal symmetry because of the complex, because there's complex numbers in the Hamiltonian. Okay. So let me now re-diagonalize this 2x2 matrix to get the band energies. Okay. So what you'll find is that when these second neighbor hopping terms are present, you get a gap in these Dirac points in your spectrum. Okay, so in other words, more physically, your previously gapless semi-metal transforms into a band insulator upon adding these imaginary hopping terms. So you may be inclined to think that the physics has actually become less interesting, at least from a theoretical standpoint. You might think what could be more boring than a band insulator. But the point I want to now make is that this band insulator, which Haldane obtained a long time ago, is far from being the kind of conventional band insulator that you would read about in a textbook. Okay? So this is far from being a conventional Ashcroft or Merman style band insulator. In fact, there's something very subtle and quite non-trivial about this Hamiltonian. In some very rough sense, what distinguishes this band insulator from an ordinary band insulator is that the electron wave functions have become non-trivially knotted in momentum space, okay? And in a way which is fundamentally different from what you would have in a conventional Ashcroft or Merman type band insulator. So those are just some words which are, I think, somewhat helpful, but let me put some more meat on that in the following way. So let me first note the fact that I can write this 2x2 matrix in the following way. So I can introduce some momentum-dependent vector H dotted into a vector of polymatrices. Okay, so I can always write a Hamiltonian in this way. So for example, if I look at the z component of this vector, that's actually just mk because the diagonal terms look like mk times the sigma z polymatrix. Okay, and then the x and y components of that vector will just be related to the real and imaginary parts of this ck function.
So, yeah. This is a very nice simple model. Now, yeah. Yeah, depends on m and sigma and psi.
The gap depends only on M here, actually.
And it depends only on the fact that it's actually, if you add a term to make it time reversal, then the gap will cancel out.
Okay, I'm not sure I know what you mean by adding a term to make it time reversal.
Suppose you make it time reversal. I mean, suppose you add whatever. So with time reversal, HK should change sign, so it's not a problem.
Okay, but if I
somehow I want to see what's the origin of the gap. Yeah. The gap, because it comes from M, you said, right?
That's right, yeah.
But if you were to write all this explicitly, find out which term is time reversal, which is not.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the gap come only from the non?
It's only from the time reversal breaking piece here.
That's
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you can introduce a real matrix element here, and that won't open up a gap in the spectrum. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it depends on, okay.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. So it's really that very precise imaginary second neighbor hopping term which breaks symmetry, which underlies.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
If
that's right.
You change the sign of k.
Yeah.
What happens to this term?
So this will be, I think it's odd under that, under k to minus k.
Yes,
yeah.
It's perfectly allowed.
What do you mean, perfectly allowed?
By time reversal symmetry.
So time reversal does a complex conjugates, right? So that this is.
So sigma also changes sign, provided that sigma changes sign.
No. So sigma doesn't change. So this is not a real spin here. You're thinking about spin. So this is a pseudo spin. Maybe I shouldn't have used sigma, right? But the sigma multiplies the AB sublattice space, and that doesn't change under time reversal. No, of course. I mean, so these are the presence of this of these A and B sublattices are connected to lattice physics, not spin, right?
If it doesn't change sign with time reversal, then HK cannot change sign.
So H transforms into a different vector under time reversal symmetry. It's not the same Hamiltonian.
But is it a symmetry transformation of graphene?
I'm not at graphene. Okay, so this is a toy model. This is not graphene. So I'm back in theory. Then I'm going to get to the physical graphene in a minute. So, and then I think things will become much more physically clear cut. Okay, so now let me do one more thing before I discuss physics of these kind of Hamiltonians. I want to take this momentum vector, momentum dependent vector H and normalize it. Okay, and I can always do that as long as HK is non-zero for every point in the Brillouin zone, and I'm going to assume for now that it is. Okay, so I've now let me consider a general class of Hamiltonians of this type in order to expose exactly what's so special about Haldane's band insulator. Okay, so now I can think about the unit vector HK as being a map. Okay, which if you tell me some point in the Brillouin zone using that function HK, I can HK gives you some point along the unit sphere. Okay, does that make sense? So it's just a function which maps you from the Brillouin zone to some point along the unit sphere. Now what I want to do, I want to take move k along some particular cut in the Brillouin zone and watch how this unit vector sweeps out along the unit sphere. Okay, I'm just going to do this for some arbitrary problem, arbitrary Hamiltonian. So the first thing I want to do is maybe just sweep k from here to here. And when I do that, h in general will sweep out some contour on the unit sphere. I can keep going. H sweeps out some more contour along the unit sphere. Now, when I get here, that's actually related to this point by a reciprocal lattice vector. So if I just keep going, I get back to where I started. Okay. So H has to sweep out some closed contour when I go along such a trajectory. Okay. Now, let's imagine we do this exercise not just tracing out some particular contour in momentum space, but sweeping over the entire Brillouin zone. Now, the meaningful question you can ask in this case is how many times did that unit vector cover the entire unit sphere? Yeah.
Basically, your k was always on the sphere, right?
K is in the Brillouin zone. K is a momentum. Yeah.
K was always on the sphere.
HK, right?
HK is on the unit sphere, yeah.
HK was on
the unit sphere.
Yeah. So that's right.
Why the trajectory on the sphere is non-trivial? Well, you know, K went along a single line. K is a straight line. Why?
There's absolutely nothing special. So the only thing I wanted to make here is that whatever this vector did, it had to come back to where it started because I started and ended at the same point in the Brillouin zone. This is absolutely nothing special about this trajectory I drew. It could very well have been that, you know, H didn't move at all when I moved along that contour. You know, H could have swept out some completely different contour. There's no meaning to that. There's no kind of topological structure in when I just scan over a particular contour in the Brillouin zone. Right. So that's what I'm trying to get to something.
If you expand HK in terms of K, that would not be a trajectory.
What do you mean, expand HK in terms of K?
Well, you know, take linear contribution, cubic contribution, whatever.
So this, yeah, but this, yes, okay, you can do that, but then that's only...
powers of K.
Okay.
Then you won't have this trajectory.
But what you're suggesting that I do, it will tell me only about, you know, what happens to HK in some small window.
If it would be some multiple connected trajectory on the right, on the left, then it would be that trajectory on the left. So, but otherwise, yeah. It looks to me that K almost stands at the point.
Okay, I'm not sure I understand your point. So yeah, maybe I'll go on. Sorry.
For any path like that in any Brillouin zone. Right?
This is completely generic. Completely generic. Yeah, at least for 2D Brillouin zone, yeah. Right? Yeah, completely generic.
Okay, so the point is the following: imagine you have not HK dot sigma, but imagine you have K dot sigma.
Okay.
So then, if you change this way K, you won't get the trajectory for K on the sphere.
That's a completely different problem. I'm not sure I understand the point. Yeah, sorry, I don't understand.
He's asking if HK would be just K, the vector K.
Is K.
The answer is no.
No, of course it can't, right? Because this is a.
Then the trajectories on the right and on the left are different.
Okay, so I think the point is that, you know, HK is defined on a Brillouin zone, which is topologically like a torus. Okay, so it can't just be K, right? Because then you lose a periodicity, which has to be here.
You need some constant component for that. In HK, you need to have a constant component independent of K in order to have that.
That's fine. Yeah. So let's assume you did. Yeah. I didn't. Yeah. I never precluded that. Yeah. Okay. So let's perform that exercise when we scan momenta across the whole Brillouin zone. Okay. So now there is a topologically meaningful question we can ask here, which is how many times did that unit vector H cover the entire unit sphere? Okay. So it can only do that an integer number of times. It could be 0, 1, 2, or so on, but it can't be, you know, a half or something. Okay. That number can't change smoothly when you deform the Hamiltonian in a smooth way. Okay, so that integer defines a topological invariant, which is exactly what's going to distinguish Haldane's insulator from a conventional band insulator that you read about in textbooks. Let's see. So it's integers, right? I mean, this can
it's
be
all
an integer.
Integers.
Yeah, it's all integers. All integers. Yeah.
Because left is the torus, right is the sphere.
That's right. Yeah. So it's all integers. Okay, so now if you carry out this exercise for an ordinary band insulator, which for concreteness, in the context of these spinless fermions on the honeycomb lattice, you can imagine putting the system into a charge density wave state where you preferentially put fermions on the A sublattice versus the B sublattice. What you'll find is that uh, the that vector H may sweep out some area, but then it comes back to it, back to where you started. And in fact, the topological invariant in this case would be zero. Okay, this would cover the in this case you'd cover the unisphere exactly zero times. Okay, so that corresponds to a topologically trivial insulator, which is again like your ordinary textbook insulator, which has been known for many decades. So it turns out in Haldane's insulator, that unit vector covers the sphere exactly one time. Okay. And so that's what's so special about Haldane's insulator. In fact, there's some non-trivial topological structure to the wave functions.
Is it possible to cover it in two times?
Sure, you can. Yeah.
Are those also non-trivial?
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean by good insulator? In what sense it's ordinary? In what sense Haldane?
Yeah. So what I mean by insulator, I'm strictly speaking referring to bulk conduction. Okay. So there's a bulk band gap. And therefore, it's hard to get current to flow through the bulk of the system. It's true in the bulk, yeah. So I should be careful what I mean.
If conductivity doesn't exist in the bulk, that's insulator.
Well, if it's zero, right? Yeah. So I want it to be, or you know, so to tie it into experiments, at least if you ignored, you know, contributions from the edges, in both of these cases, you would find exponentially activated conduction. There's a bulk gap. You can't send current through the bulk.
Any specific features of MK or
No, this is special to this is very special to Haldane's MK.
Okay.
That's right.
You didn't tell us exactly where it is.
Yeah, I mean it's not that illuminating. I could write it down, but believe me it's not illuminating. But the main point, actually to tie it to some things that we already mentioned here, the main point is that MK actually changes sign depending on where you are in the Brillouin zone. Whereas that vector doesn't actually change sign. It's a constant sign everywhere in the Brillouin zone for this case. Okay. So you can maybe see why it's essential for MK to change sign, because if it didn't change sign, then you'd always be confined to the upper half of the unit sphere.
Right.
Okay, so it's essential that you actually
you can go to lower half as long as you not go through a south pole.
Not if MK is always positive, let's say, yeah, because that's the z component of that vector basically. So okay, all right. So now. The last point I want to make here before going on is that the spectra, the energy spectrum and the band structure might look almost exactly the same for these two insulators, but because they're distinguished by this global topological property, you can't actually go smoothly from one to the other without closing a gap. So that actually has very striking experimental consequences and leads to the formation of edge states if you have your system defined with a boundary. Okay. So for instance, suppose I have Haldane's insulator in some well-defined two-dimensional region, and outside I just have ordinary vacuum. Okay. So ordinary vacuum is topologically trivial. I don't think anyone would question that. Whereas Haldane's insulator is topologically non-trivial. So if you actually go from here to here, you're guaranteed to have, you absolutely have to close the gap at some point. Okay. And that gap closure leads to the existence of chiral edge states in the system. Okay.
It's kind of understandable why there are chiral edge states in the quantum polar time because of
the
magnetic field.
That's right.
What makes the edge state chiral here?
Well, it's the fact that you broke time reversal symmetry, right? So this is why it's basically impossible for this Hamiltonian to have any sense of time reversal symmetry. There's something which goes along one way. Right?
If you reverse your imaginary arrow, you reverse the
That's
state,
right. right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's as kind of appealing a physical picture if you just think about, you know, the...
Imagine that the time reversal symmetry is somehow violated in then you allow chiral stage state.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the question about how it is violated is just a toy model.
Just a toy model, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, maybe just as a side, I mean, there are things that people think about these days called quantum anomalous Hall states, which really are more physical realizations of this kind of Hamiltonian, but they can arise in systems that actually have spin. But that's okay. That's a subject for another talk. So this chiral edge state, if I, let's say, look at the energy versus K for the top edge, you just get some linear dispersion indicating that mode is moving to the right, and there's nothing actually moving to the left. Okay? Now, if you were to perform a conductance measurement, what you'll find here is that because of this chiral edge state, the Hall conductivity is quantized exactly at E squared over H. Okay? So no doubt many people in this room are experts in fractal quantum Hall physics, so this probably reminds you of a related system, namely a quantum Hall effect. But the remarkable thing about Haldane's model that he introduced a long time ago, and I think it's the reason he was so interested in this problem, is that here one is getting a quantum Hall effect in these chiral edge states without a magnetic field. Okay? So I think there's a kind of deep message here, which is that magnetic field is not actually essential for getting edge states and quantum Hall physics. It's really the time reversal breaking aspect, which is the fundamental thing, right? Not necessarily the field. Okay, so all of this so far has been discussed in the context of a fictitious toy model, which I think led to some confusion, I'm sorry to say. I apologize for that.
So you're saying that magnetic field is not essential for but if you have two, so what would prevent scattering?
Two? Sorry, what, two?
If you have two states, you know, magnetic field, there is just one direction.
Yeah.
If you have two, what would prevent scattering between them?
So by two, do you mean two edge states? Or?
Yeah, why there is just one? There could be another one in the opposite direction.
Yeah, so...
Why there is none?
Because we don't have spin, okay? Yeah. But I'm getting there, and I think I will satisfy you in a minute. Okay, so everything so far has been discussed in the context of a toy model, which, you know, is...
What was Duncan's motivation to come up with this model?
You know, who knows? I mean, I don't know, but it's interesting to ask.
Context, you know? I mean, it's beautiful.
Well, I think that, you know, there's something, I think in the title of the paper is something like condensed matter realization of the parity anomaly or something.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yeah. But, you know, what led him to this is a very interesting question, and but I think it's, you know, often quite puzzling, you know, what to try to understand his thinking. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, he's just, you know, so ahead of his time. Okay, so now I want to make things a little bit more physical, and I hope this will make things a bit clearer. I want to now go back to a more physical problem where we restore the spin degree of freedom for the electrons in graphene. Okay. So now let's fast forward almost 20 years compared to Haldane's work. So very recently in 2005, Kane and Millais made the, I think, quite beautiful discovery that the physics I just described to you actually gets even more interesting if you make the problem more realistic and include the spin degree of freedom for graphene. Okay. I think that's somewhat philosophically interesting in the sense that often when theorists you know, write down some model which is not particularly realistic, and then you try to make things more realistic, usually it gets less interesting, but here it actually became more interesting. So in this case, once you have spin, you can actually define a time reversal invariant version of Haldane's model. Okay, and we can do that in a conceptually very simple way. So let me consider for the spinned up electrons, let me take their Hamiltonian to be just exactly Haldane's model. Okay, so I have nearest neighbor hopping and these imaginary second neighbor hoppings with this particular orientation. For the spin-down electrons, I also want to take Haldane's model, but complex conjugated. Okay, so in effect, that simply reverses all of these errors for the spin-down electrons compared to the spin-up electrons. Okay, so this, in fact, Hamiltonian, which I've just described to you, is time-reversal invariant. And the reason it's time-reversal invariant is that under time-reversal, spin-up transforms into spin-down and vice versa. Okay, so even though each sector, if you view it in terms of spinless fermions, breaks time-reversal symmetry, the physical time-reversal symmetry that you have for spin actually allows you to preserve time-reversal. Okay, so the phase of matter that one goes to here is in fact gapped, which is I think pretty natural because each of these Hamiltonians, which are just living in independent blocks, are both gapped. It's preserved time reversal symmetry, and in fact this is also an interesting so-called topological insulator, which has similar topological features which are inherited from Haldane's model. Okay, now a natural question you might ask is why in the world would the electrons ever decide to behave in this crazy spin-dependent fashion with these unusual looking, you know, second neighbor hopping terms. So it definitely doesn't look like a very natural Hamiltonian to consider. Now, the absolutely beautiful thing here is that, in fact, if you simply turn on the intrinsic spin-orbit coupling that's always present to some degree in pure graphene, that's, you know, coming from the carbon atoms, those intrinsic spin-orbit coupling terms generate exactly these imaginary spin-dependent second neighbor hoppings and, in fact, drive you into this topological insulator phase. Okay, so that's what Kane and Millais established a few years ago. Yeah. So this is just pure single particle physics. Yeah.
Yeah, I was asking a question. Is due perturbation, the perturbative normalization group with the interaction, even local interaction, is that robust?
Well, certainly it will be if you start off with a big imaginary second neighbor. Yeah. So you turn on weak interactions and nothing happens. Of course, it becomes more subtle if you have strong, you know, interactions which are strong on the scale of that gap. And that I'm not sure anyone. Actually, there's been some work which I'll mention briefly that's somewhat marginally connected to that.
Sorry, maybe one question. In this case, you have at the edge, you have left movers and right movers.
Yeah, so I'm getting to that. Yeah, so
and
so. Okay, yeah, so I'm getting exactly to that point here. Okay, so just as Haldane's model had these had a chiral edge state, here we actually have two edge states. Okay, because we have spin. Let's say for the spin-up particles, I have a clockwise circulating mode, and for spin-down, I have a counterclockwise circulating mode. Okay. So if I, for instance, think about the energy versus k for the top edge, I get a spin up mode, which is moving to the right, and a spin down mode now, which is moving to the left. Okay. Now it sort of had to be this way because we preserve time reversal symmetry, so there's no alternative here. Now as you rightly point out, the stability of these modes now becomes a rather subtle issue. Okay. But now time reversal comes and saves the day here, because you can't actually elastically backscatter from one mode to the other without flipping a spin. Okay, so that's a somewhat simplified picture. But as long as you have no magnetic impurities in your system, it's actually impossible to elastically backscatter between these modes. Okay.
So what kicks the direction? So a perfectly similar state is to have your brown arrow running the other way and the green arrow the other way. So what? White graphene peaks this, or I don't know, does it peak this one and not the other one?
Yeah, that's a... I'm not sure I have a good answer to that. It's quite...
I know in the 3D Tobolev theory is the sign of the spin orbit.
It is. It's a sign of the spin orbit coupling again, but...
Is it also?
It's a sign of the spin orbit coupling for sure, but I mean, what selects that sign is not so obvious. I mean, there's some term in your Hamiltonian which gives you some sign, right? And, yeah.
This crossing picture occurs because actually the time reversal symmetry prevents you from scattering of one into another, right?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
Imagine there is a third electron nearby.
Okay. You mean a third band, or?
A singlet and a triplet state. And my green is scattered with that electron. Once
Sorry.
I have that, there is a gap.
Right, there's a question of what impurities do, and there's a question of what electron-electron does.
Yeah, I'm asking about electron-electron interactions.
Yeah, okay, so electron-electron interactions, at least... They do nothing up to a finite critical interaction strength. Okay, so this is stable to I think even reasonably strong interactions.
In one dimension.
Why there is one dimension? Because you have a two-dimensional sample. Why are you talking about that?
Yeah. Well, these modes are completely localized along the boundary of the system.
That's precisely what I'm asking. If there is an electron nearby in the bulk.
The bulk is inert, right? Let's assume there's a big infinite gap in the bulk, right? So the bulk is doing nothing, for low energy physics.
I can localize the electron there, and it will still interact with the green or with red.
So those localized electrons, you can think about those just from so essentially you're thinking about disorder, right? So disorder doesn't localize these things.
Right? Unless you have magnetic impurities.
If you have magnetic impurities, yeah.
No, it doesn't.
Sorry, what was your point? What was your question?
In 1 plus 1, co-fermion interaction in relativistic quantum field theory normalizes logarithmically. That's asymptotically free. I'm not sure about your statement. I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong. About finite strength.
Well, okay, so
it's like a Luttinger, right?
Is this a Luttinger liquid, which could be
a Luttinger liquid, right?
It's a spinless Luttinger liquid, right? In the sense that you have two modes, right? It's one species, one right left mover, one right mover.
Right, yeah.
Of course, you have this will be a Luttinger liquid if you turn on interactions,
right.
But electron-electron interactions don't open a gap unless they. There's some cosine term which has to become relevant. Yeah.
Okay, fine.
It's a Luttinger liquid, sure. Yeah.
Electron-electron interactions, no. There is singlet channel and triplet channel. If there is a triplet channel, then there is exchange of two.
I'm not sure.
What will happen there?
So I think you're thinking in terms of a spinful Luttinger liquid, but this is effectively a spinless Luttinger liquid, right? So, yeah. Okay, so. These gapless edge states are really protected by time reversal symmetry. So there's lots of literature on this. If you don't believe me, and another thing I should mention that you need is particle conservation. So if you actually make the edge superconducting, you can also gap out these edges. But short of those two things, you really can't do anything to remove these edge states. And you can even introduce relatively strong disorder, and they'll still survive. So this actually leads to a quite striking experimental prediction. Namely, if I do a two-terminal measurement, so maybe I put some contact on the left side, some contact on the right side, and just do a two-terminal measurement, at low temperatures at least, the conduction that I should get is quantized at 2e squared over h. Okay? So the way you can understand the two here is basically you have a perfectly transmitting 1D channel up on the top edge and another perfectly transmitting 1D channel on the bottom edge. Okay? And it's the absence of elastic backscattering which guarantees the perfect transmission. So at finite temperature, you can have inelastic processes which reduce this, but at least at very low temperatures, this result is robust.
This would be mesoscopic. I mean, this would be totally coherent.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Can actually go around. Yeah. Making an inelastic scattering.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's right. So in fact, in experiments where they saw this phase, they had to shrink down their sample to the point where they were smaller than the inelastic length. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Question?
No.
It's okay. Yeah.
You have 25 minutes to show your main result.
Okay. Okay, I'll speed up. So let me just briefly highlight why this is interesting in case it's not so clear. So I think on a very general setting, way, I think this is interesting because these topological insulators are really new topological phases of matter which require them neither strong interactions nor big magnetic fields. The only requirement here is really just spin orbit coupling, which is always present in some degree. So I emphasize strong interactions and big magnetic fields just to, you know, make connection to quantum Hall effect. So I'm definitely not suggesting that these things are replacing quantum Hall effect. You can never do that. But I think in terms of, you know, finding new topological phases that allow you to expand the horizons of experimental study of topological phases, this is an absolutely wonderful feature. Okay, so theorists are quite good at making predictions for non-interacting electrons. And that's why actually this field has proceeded with the pace that it has. Okay. So the fact that these edge states are spin filtered in the sense that, you know, there's a clockwise mode with one spin, a counterclockwise mode with the other spin, you might imagine that there's some spintronics applications that one could realize with these systems. The absence of elastic backscattering has led some people to suggest that there's maybe applications for low dissipation electronics. From my perspective, I think that these are great systems for finding exotic particles called Majorana fermions. So this is really a subject for a whole other talk, and I'm happy to talk privately with people about this after. But let me just note that these particles have very interesting properties like non-abelian statistics, and they can be used for decoherence-free quantum information processing among other interesting effects. Okay, and this is one very nice place to trap these particles. Okay, so now let me, having introduced 2D topological insulators, now let me briefly comment on the status of graphene as a material that might realize this physics. Okay, so unfortunately, graphene suffers from a very tragic flaw in regards to its potential as a topological insulating material. And that's that graphene is, of course, made of carbon, which is a very light element. It has atomic number 6. And because of this, the spin-orbit coupling is extremely weak. It's a very sad fact, but it's the case. And if you look at the gap that's actually generated by carbon spin-orbit coupling, it's extremely small. And the number is definitely less than 1 Kelvin, and most theories say somewhere between 0.1 Kelvin and 0.01 Kelvin. Okay, so that's, you know, prohibitively small. You'll never see it. Yeah.
So you are not allowed to bend it because there was a paper from Charlie Marcus saying that actually L from who's that from?
Yeah, it's okay. I know your point.
Was,
yeah.
There was a strong spin orbit coupling in graphene.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So have to bend it slightly.
Well, okay, so yeah.
It's bad for you by something.
It's bad, yeah. So the kind of spin orbit coupling you're discussing is Rochba spin orbit coupling, and that's actually detrimental to the existence of this phase. I'll mention this in a minute, actually. Okay, so the intrinsic spin orbit coupling, when you have reflection symmetry about the graphene sheet, you still have spin orbit coupling, it's just of a different type, right? Okay, so this is a sad fact about graphene, and what makes matters actually even worse is precisely the effect that you just raised. Most of the time, graphene is put on a substrate, and whenever you do that, you actually break the mirror symmetry with respect to the graphene plane. Okay, and when you do that, you generate another kind of spin-orbit coupling called Rochba spin-orbit coupling. Okay, and that Rochba actually competes with the intrinsic spin-orbit term, and so the ultimate fate of the system actually depends on one which is larger. If the intrinsic spin-orbit coupling dominates, then your tiny little gap survives. But if a Rochba spin-orbit coupling dominates, then that tiny gap closes and it's hopeless.
What do you mean by intrinsic
spin-orbit? So I mean, I just mean the spin-orbit contribution that remains when you preserve the Z to minus Z symmetry, right? When you preserve reflections about the graphene sheet. There's still spin-orbit terms that are allowed.
It's just something with one power matrix of it.
Well, all of them have one poly matrix when written in terms of this low energy Hamiltonian.
Well, how Rochba is different? Rochba has two. That's the only difference.
Oh, I see your point. Sorry. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the Rochba terms involve spin flips, right? So they involve sigma x and sigma y. These other terms don't. The intrinsic terms don't.
These other terms do not introduce spin flips. That's what you're
saying. That's right, yeah. At least, you know, if you work in the SZ quantization basis.
Okay.
Okay, and unfortunately, you know, it's often the case from, at least if you believe first principles calculations, that Rajpa dominates over the intrinsic term. It's a very, very unfortunate fact. So if you want to actually find this physics experimentally, you need to proceed in some different way. Okay, so there's at least two ways that you can proceed. Perhaps the most natural place is just to look for other materials that might also realize this physics in a more experimentally accessible way. So this, in fact, was pursued, and rightly so, by many authors, including Brunovic, Hughes, and Zhang, who predicted that mercury telluride quantum well should realize a topological insulator phase. And in fact, that was that topological insulator phase was seen experimentally by Mollenkamp's group. So here's some conductance as a function of some gate voltage measurements. And in fact, for certain samples, they saw this 2e squared over h plateau. Okay, modulo, you know, subtleties about system sizes and so on. Okay, so it was a phenomenal development, and many people in the field are very excited about this, but it leaves something to be desired in the sense that these mercury telluride experiments can really be performed by a single group in the world. I think that's probably not such a big exaggeration. I mean, maybe it's expanded somewhat, but certainly the experimental activity on this material has been quite limited. I think nobody would argue with that. Okay.
What is the case, just experimentally, where you don't have the 2e squared over 8 for the other?
I think these are for different well thicknesses, right? So you have to actually have your system within some critical well thickness before this phase appears.
One difficulty is seeing 2e squared of h, you can see that in mesoscopic example without any.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
So that just alone is not really strong.
But it's a 2D system, right? So, I mean, it's not so obvious why you should see 2e squared over h.
Well, the example they see 2e squared is actually very small.
Okay, yeah, that's fair enough, yeah. So they do have subsequent measurements which kind of confirm this edge state picture, but okay, I'm not here to defend that though, but I think it was quite an impressive experimental achievement. So there's other materials which have also been proposed, namely bilayer bismuth, and there's a indium arsenide gallium antimonide quantum well of a particular type. I think there's some progress that shows that this material may be Oh, this is bilayer. This is a bulk bismuth. This is what bulk bismuth looks like. I couldn't find a bilayer bismuth picture. Sorry, but yeah, this is what bulk bismuth looks like actually. Okay, so that. But I think there's no concrete evidence, and I'm not even sure that the work here has appeared in print yet. But anyway, so that's the experimental situation. So another thing you might try to do is to salvage the situation in graphene. Now, the natural question is, why would you ever bother doing that? Why don't you just, you know, focus all your efforts in these other systems? And I think that there's a practical answer to that, which is that from a fabrication standpoint, graphene is, I think, far preferable to all of these other systems. Okay. So if you can find a way to engineer graphene into a robust topological insulator phase, I think that would, in principle, open up the field of 2D topological insulators to a much broader spectrum of the experimental community. And if that works, then you know that could potentially lead to a lot of interesting experiments and maybe applications. Okay, so that's the motivation from my standpoint. Now, I'm not the first one to think of this, of course. The first work I know of was by Sri Raghu and company. They proposed that actually that strong interactions might stabilize a topological insulator phase, even if you didn't have any spin orbit coupling in your system. That actually requires you to have strong second neighbor repulsion, which is, I guess, somewhat natural because they're, you know, one easy second neighbor processes. It's maybe a bit challenging to get into that regime where the second neighbor coupling is so large, but in fact, Tammy, Pragbani, and Gill have a proposal that allows you to maybe tune those interaction parameters. Another interesting approach that people have suggested is to actually apply radiation to your system, and that may actually drive the system into a so-called flow-k topological insulator. Okay, so these are, I think, both interesting approaches. What I'm going to do now is take a completely different approach, and I'm going to try to allow graphene to inherit strong spin orbit coupling from a dilute concentration of heavy atoms, which you just deposit randomly into your graphene lattice. Okay? So the basic idea is that if you have a heavy element, something maybe from rows, you know, the fifth and sixth row of the periodic table, the spin orbit strength that's intrinsic to those elements is very large. It's on the electron volt scale. Now, if your carbon atoms somehow hybridize with those heavy elements, the idea is that they may kind of endow the graphene sheet with some of that strong spin orbit coupling. So that's
so
they
need them to be kind of chemisorbed, so form some chemical bonding.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I'll go into much more detail about this. So now I'm finally getting to the meat of my talk. So I think this is a very, you know, a very simple and maybe somewhat appealing viewpoint, but you know, whether it actually works is far from obvious, because the criteria that your atoms need to satisfy are actually quite strict. Okay, so first of all, we need an ad atom with a high atomic number to ensure that we get large spin orbit coupling. You also want that ad atom to enter the graphene sheet non-magnetically, because after all, we're interested in preserving time reversal symmetry. You also would like the ad atom to favor a particular place in the graphene sheet, namely the so-called hollow position. So this will hopefully become clear later on, but if the hollow position is this place which is indicated here, where basically the ad atom sits near the center of a hexagonal plaquette, kind of shifted a bit away from the graphene lattice. So it turns out that this is ideal, this location is ideal for mediating spin orbit coupling of the type we want to get. And another somewhat but absolutely crucial point is that you can notice that all of these ad atom locations, the atom's always sitting on one side of the graphene sheet. Okay, so it's always breaking that mirror symmetry with respect to the graphene plane, which implies that it's not just the intrinsic spin orbit coupling which we're going to get, but also the Rochba coupling. We want the induced intrinsic spin orbit coupling to dominate. Okay. And now the challenging thing here is that all previous studies that I'm aware of actually find that ad atoms induce primarily Rochba coupling. Okay, so this is, you know, I think probably a pretty natural thing. So these are the things we need to satisfy. Now let me give you maybe a somewhat more elaborate physical picture, but still some very rough physical picture to illustrate exactly what this ad atom, what we would like this ad atom to do. Okay. So for now, let me just assume that I found some element that satisfies all these properties, and let me try to illustrate how that will help us. Okay. So let's assume that we have some heavy element here, which is sitting in the hollow position. Again, that heavy element has enormous spin orbit coupling. And let me just imagine, you know, some rough classical picture, some electron roaming around the graphene sheet. Okay, so when that electron gets near to that heavy ad atom, there's a probability that it will tunnel onto that ad atom. Okay, and when it does that, it now locally feels this very strong spin orbit coupling, which is intrinsic to the ad atom. Okay, now there's no reason why it needs to tunnel back to where it came from. There's a chance that it will generate, it will hop over to a second neighbor site. Okay, and this process will generally be spin dependent, and one of the things that can happen is that you'll generate this imaginary second neighbor hopping along this particular bond. Okay. And similarly, we can watch this electron move around. Of course, I'm showing this in a highly biased way, but the idea is that that atom can locally mediate in its vicinity very large intrinsic spin orbit coupling, which is what we want to happen. Okay. So that's the basic idea. But of course, I've done a lot of cherry picking here. Right? There are lots of other things that are going to happen here. And one thing that's going to happen is that atom will also generate Rochba spin orbit coupling. Okay, and this is a big nuisance, and we want to get rid of it. I'm going to just tell you in words that there's an absolutely crucial part of what I'm going to describe here, which is that this Rochba effect, which is generated, is actually always unimportant if your ad atom orbitals are coming from p shells. Okay, so that's far from obvious, but it's basically a symmetry reason behind that. So I'll maybe just describe in a sentence or two what's happening here. Now, if it turns out that if for such an ad atom, if you look at the kind of Rochba spin orbit terms that are generated, they actually have exactly zero weight at the Dirac points, which is where all the action is happening. Okay? And there's basically a symmetry reason for that. Whereas if you look at the intrinsic spin orbit terms which are generated by the atom, they do have significant contribution near the Dirac points.
Does that just come from the radio wave function penetrating the nucleus?
Let's see. So it really comes from the available orbitals that are accessible with P shells. I had a couple of slides to illustrate this in some more detail, but it's the fact that you only have m equals 0 plus or minus 1 shells, and hopping onto the m equals 0 shell is a thing which has no weight, okay? And these Rochba spin orbit terms are generated when you hop onto the m equals 0 shell, flip your spin, and then come back through an m equals 1 shell. And so that's the only process where you can flip the spin. If you have a D or F shells, then there's more shells where you can tunnel onto an M equals 1 shell, tunnel back from an M equals 2 shell, and that actually won't vanish. So that's what's special about these P orbitals. So that's probably not too clear, but I'm happy to go into more details about this. But this is really quite crucial, which is why I'm emphasizing it.
You're envisaging an ad atom per hollow space there, right?
Because no, dilute. This is very dilute.
That's right.
Exactly. So this is an issue which we're going to have to address. Okay, which I'm not going to do. I'm not going to get to this. Yeah. Okay. So now let's ask whether there are any elements which satisfy all the properties which I just introduced. How am I doing on time, by the way?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay. I think I'm probably okay. So here's our periodic table. This is what we have to work from. So What's most interesting here are these elements in the fifth and sixth rows of the periodic table, because those are heavy and have a strong spin-orbit coupling. And I guess quite naturally we want to avoid stuff down here, right? So with the skill set that I have, there's absolutely no way for me to make a reliable prediction about which of these elements are good to use. That's where my DFT colleagues come into play. So they've done density functional theory studies to try to see if any of these elements are actually suitable. Okay. And it could have easily been that none of these elements have the right properties. But in fact, what they found is that two elements, indium and thallium, satisfy all of our criteria. Okay. So indium is pretty heavy. It has atomic number 49. Thallium is even heavier. It has atomic number 81. Both of these elements favor the hollow position in the graphene sheet. They both actually enter the graphene sheet non-magnetically, which is good. Physically, what's going on is that each of these neutral atoms have one electron in their outer P shell, and that electron actually just gets donated to the graphene sheet. Okay, and then you're left with something which is non-magnetic. So that's what happens. Okay, so now I'm going to focus for the rest of the talk on these two elements. We'd like to understand quantitatively their effects on graphene. And it's simplest to actually start with a periodic arrangement of those atoms. That's not what we're ultimately interested in, but just as a stepping stone, let's consider that. Now what I'm going to show you is density functional theory results for the coverage 1/16th, so which means that we have one atom and every 16 plaquettes. Okay, so you get this kind of periodic arrangement shown here. And I'm only considering this because we can utilize density functional theory to get a nice quantitative understanding of what these atoms do. Okay, so now let me start with showing you the results for indium. For comparison, I'm gonna show you first what happens when you don't have spin orbit coupling. Okay, so they can just turn off spin orbit coupling in their simulations. And here's what you get for indium. So there's a lot of bands here because we've reduced translation symmetry quite significantly. The important feature here is what happens near the Dirac point. And if you zoom in, then what you see is there's a nice massless Dirac cone. Okay. So this is a good thing. Before we turn on spin orbit coupling, we don't want to be generating any insulating state. Okay. So this is good. Now, if you turn on spin orbit coupling, what happens is the band structure evolves to what you see here. So on this scale, you can't really see anything. But if you zoom in fact, there's a 7 millielectron volt band gap that's generated. Okay, so that's actually not so small. We were very encouraged by this. 7 millielectron volts, first of all, is around 3 to 4 orders of magnitude larger than what you get for just pure carbon, which is already quite a big boost. And in fact, 7 millielectron volts is close to the gap that you have in mercury telluride, which is around 10 millielectron volts. So we were quite encouraged by this result, and note that this is for the lighter of our two elements. Okay, so it's natural to expect.
And that 10 millivolt is bulk gap.
That's the bulk gap. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let me just mention that we also looked at other coverages. At 4% coverage, you still get a reasonably large 5 millielectron volt gap, and at a rather small 2% coverage, the gap is 3 millielectron volts. Okay.
The higher the coverage, the higher the gap.
That's right. Quite naturally, right? Because you the more atoms there are, the more plaquettes. That you're generating this spin orbit coupling inside of. Yeah, I think then they start to interact, and you don't want that. Well, necessarily, I don't actually know the answer, but I think it's certainly not a monotonic rise, right? So there's probably some saturation that happens. It becomes a rather different problem once you have a pretty dense set of these atoms. I mean, at the 6% coverage, they already don't talk to each other very much. Okay, so the chemistry just gets much more complicated. Okay, so now let me show you the results for the heavier of our candidate elements, thallium. Here's again what you get before you introduce spin orbit coupling. Once again, if you zoom in on this Dirac point, in fact the Dirac cone remains massless. Okay, which is again good. We didn't want to generate a gap before spin orbit coupling. With spin orbit coupling, here's what you get. You can almost start to see a band gap even on this scale, but if you zoom in, it's actually pretty large. Now it's 21 millielectron volts. Okay. So that's actually not so far from room temperature. We were actually quite encouraged by this result. And actually, so we were communicating with Josh Folk, who some of you may know about this work. And, we sent him an excited email telling him about this result. And his response was actually a bit sobering. So he said, this happens to be the most toxic element that you could have chosen. Thanks. And, okay, so I have really no compelling response to that, except to say that, if you're brave and, you want to try to do some interesting physics with graphene, this may be an interesting thing to try, particularly if you have some graduate students around that you want to experiment with. Okay, so for other coverages, you also get still substantial gaps. Even at 2% coverage, actually, the gap is 10 millielectron volts. All right, so what I've shown you so far is that there's certainly a gap in these periodic ad-atom arrangements that's due only to spin-orbit coupling. It's very suggestive that that's indicative of the emergence of a topological inflator, but we'd like to do something a little bit more compelling than that. So what we turn to is actually tight binding simulations for this periodic ad-atom arrangement. So our tight binding model consisted of three pieces. There's a graphene-only piece, which accounts for uniform hopping and some chemical potential, which is larger around these six sites to screen the positive charge from that ad-atom. There's also an ad-atom-only part, which just contains the p orbitals with crystal field and spin-orbit coupling. And then there's finally a term which couples graphene to the ad-atom, and that we just assumed spin-independent tunneling to those m equals 0 plus or minus 1 orbitals. Okay, so there's quite a lot of parameters here, so it's pretty natural that you should be able to do a good job of fitting the results. So here's the results for indium. Here's a density functional theory when you have spin-orbit coupling, and here's what you get from our tight binding model, and I think the agreement is actually quite good. So this gives us some confidence that, you know, it's not only low energy, but also the high energy physics, which is being captured here quite well. Here's what we get for thallium. Here's the DFT with spin orbit, and here's our tight binding model. I think it looks even a little bit better than the indium case. So that's what we find. And the advantage here is that, at least for me, if I have a tight binding model, I can do a lot of things with it. And there's many ways in which you can imagine using that tight binding model to verify that this insulating state is in fact corresponds to a quantum spin or to a topological insulator phase. One thing you could do is try to look for the edge states. You can try to compute topological invariance. Those are certainly doable. But what we decided to do instead is just demonstrate adiabatic continuity to the Kane-Mallet model. Okay, so the Kane-Mallet model was the model that I wrote down earlier, where you just have uniform spin-orbit coupling of Haldane type for the two spins. Okay, so let me do this in the following way. So I'll define a Hamiltonian, which depends on some parameter lambda, which interpolates from our graphene ad-atom problem to the Kane-Mallet model as lambda varies from 0 to 1. Okay, so we know that when lambda is 0, this Hamiltonian is describing the gapped phase of our ad-atom problem. And when lambda is 1, the Hamiltonian is just exactly the Kane-Mallet model, which we know realizes a gapped topological insulator phase. Okay, so now the question you can ask is, are these two gap states actually smoothly connected? Okay, so in other words, as I vary lambda from 0 to 1, does the Dirac point gap ever close? If it does, then you worry. If it doesn't, then they're really the same phase. Okay, so in fact, these two phases are connected. Here's the energy gap as a function of lambda. At lambda equals 0, we have our ad-atom problem. So here, the blue curve corresponds to indium. So here's our 7 millielectron volt gap for indium. The red curve corresponds to thallium. Here's our 21 millielectron volt gap. And as you tune to the Kane-Mallet model, the gap always remains finite.
Wait, I thought the Kane-Mallet gap is very small.
Oh, so yeah, this is with just some arbitrary parameter inserted for the spin-orbit coupling in Kane-Mallet model.
It's not the
model relevant for carbon, for the actual carbon atoms. But I mean, the point, it would be exactly the same. It's just you would have to track this down almost to zero, right? So it's easier to see.
Basically saying that if there is a large gap, then actually it goes from one to the other longer, basically.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's some path where you can smoothly go from one to the other.
It's true only if the gap is large to start with. If the gap were to be small, the behavior could have been completely different.
Yeah, but I think it doesn't matter because there would still be some trajectory in parameter space where you could use to connect the two phases. I think this is evidence of that. But that just means that you probably took a not smart trajectory to get from one to the other.
And then drop from big Kane-Mallet down to small to get Kane-Mallet.
Exactly. That would just be the right path to take in that case. Okay, so we know that atoms can, in principle, stabilize a topological insulator state, at least when they're periodically arranged. Okay, but again, this isn't our main focus. We want to consider what happens when they're randomly distributed. Now, once you consider a random ad-atom case, you lose notion of band structure. Okay, it's not a terribly helpful thing in that case, so you need to do something else. And what we decided to do is to probe the quantized conductance that you expect for the topological insulator state. Okay, so that's if you want to think about it as some kind of order parameter for the topological insulator phase. So we calculated the conductance using some Landau-Boudicker formalism, using some recursive Green's function approach. And here's what you get. This is the conductance as a function of the Fermi energy for three different ad-atom coverages, so 10, 20, and 30%. And what you can see is that in all cases, you get a nice, robust 2 E squared over H plateau, which is telling us that, in fact, even with random ad-atom configurations, you can stabilize this phase in this way. Okay, so the periodicity is actually not required. So I should emphasize that the data I'm showing you here doesn't correspond to the more microscopically faithful tight binding model. This is some more phenomenological model where we just have a bunch of random plaquettes with imaginary second neighbor hopping inserted into them. But we've checked lots of different things. So you can include Rochebeth spin orbit coupling of the type that you generate from the ad atoms. Doesn't change anything qualitatively. You can include these modulated chemical potentials around the ad atoms. You can include uncorrelated and correlated disorder, and in all cases we find the same physics remaining. Okay. So I should maybe comment briefly on the issue of disorder, because I think that's what's going to be most relevant for experimentalists. So in the case of uncorrelated disorder, this plateau that we find is amazingly robust against that type of disorder. That chemical potential can vary on a scale which is much larger than the gap before you even see signs of that plateau being reduced. The case of correlated disorder, which is more relevant for experiment, is more damaging to this plateau. And what we find is that the chemical potential needs to vary on a scale which is smaller than the mobility gap for the system in order for you to see the plateau. If you have big chemical potential variations, those will kill you. Okay, so I'm just about done. Okay, so I'll be very quick here. Let me just mention some challenges because there are many experimentalists in the audience. The most serious challenge here, I think, is the fact that these ad atoms, they dope graphene rather heavily. And the Fermi level, we'd like it to be here inside of that gap that we open up. But in fact, it shifts rather substantially away from the gap. And the amount, depends on coverage, of course, and it varies from around 0.5 to 1 electron volt. So that's not a small amount. And I don't think it's easy to gate with kind of conventional techniques. Although there are methods, so you can use ferroelectric substrates, ionic liquid gates, and maybe I think promising router has to introduce some other type of high electronegativity atom into your sheet to absorb some of the electrons that are donated. Okay, so this is probably my biggest concern, but I think it's not impossible to get around. Another potential worry is that atoms might like to cluster. I don't have anything to say about this. I think it's an issue which needs to be sorted out experimentally. But I think my feeling is that, at least that the atoms are sufficiently dilute that they don't really talk to each other, I think you're probably okay. And finally, of course, there's an important issue of residual disorder in the graphene sheet. I've already mentioned that in the previous slide. Let me again just reiterate that the chemical potential can fluctuate on the scale of roughly 10 millielectron volts or so, and you're okay if you have a much dirtier sample where chemical potential fluctuates much more strongly than that, then I think you're in trouble. Okay, and so people that I've talked to tell me that this is definitely possible with currently achievable samples. Okay, so for experimental detection, I think the first thing one would want to do is use ARPES or STM to detect the presence of this gap. And the reason is that ARPES, neither ARPES nor STM suffers from the doping problem, so there's not an issue whatsoever. In fact, electron doping helps in the case of ARPES, so that you can actually probe states below the Fermi energy. STM is also a very interesting approach, I think, because that'll allow you to not only sense the bulk gap, but also understand the spatial structure of the local density of states as you move away from ad atoms, and hopefully even probe the difference between bulk and edge conduction in the system. So I think that would be a really interesting thing to do. Transport is much more challenging, again, because of this chemical potential shift, but if you can successfully gate your system all the way back down to the insulating regime, then you should see that 2E squared over H plateau. Okay, so I'm going to just basically finish with a punchline, which is that I think from my point of view, I think graphene may ultimately, in fact, function as a practical topological insulator. And I think one promising approach to doing that is introducing heavy atoms, as I've tried to describe here. And if this is successful, I think there's a lot of interesting future directions that one can explore. In particular, from my point of view, the most interesting thing would be to try to find Majorana fermions on a graphene topological insulator edge, although that's certainly biased by my current interest. So anyway, thank you for your attention.
Maybe one question? Okay.
So you said that if you had used a P atom, uh-huh, your middle atom, it had not much effect on your on the gap.
That's right.
And what would be the difference? So all your calculations were done with including
Rochebeth
coupling with
the atom. All the density functional theory and the first tight binding simulations that I showed you were indeed. And we've also done conduction calculations, including that Rochebeth spin orbit coupling.
Okay, so if you had used a D atom, for mm-hmm. example, so what would be the difference in the gap if you had used the P atom and the D atom?
So that's a question which is totally dependent on the Hamiltonian. actually. There's no way I can give you an answer. It depends on, you know, details of crystal field splitting and you know, details of the spin orbit coupling and so on, what element you have, where it sits. But it can still work. It just depends on, so ideally you'd like, let's say, the m equals 2 orbitals, which are the new orbitals that you introduce, to be high in energy, okay, far from the Fermi level. And if that's the case, then I think you're okay. And the physics is probably very similar to the p orbital case. But if somehow, if crystal field splitting is weak and you're generating, you know, comparable intrinsic and Rashba spin orbit coupling, I think you're probably in trouble for that.
So there is a chance that the gap closes up with the p
orbital. I think it's possible, yeah, yeah. So it's the magic of these p orbitals, that becomes a complete non-issue.
Yeah, this is for practical experimentalist materials guys. When your Fermi energy has moved substantially at EV. So do you have you're talking about basically compensating the material by putting in impurities. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to do that at a fairly substantial level. Mm-hmm. In semiconductors, that usually mucks up the problem, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You break symmetries. And do you have a sense for what level you need to do this at? And will it, you know, the fundamental physics be altered in any significant way?
Okay, so...
If you dope heavily enough, you could have correlated disorder in the system.
That's right. Yeah. So if I think there's hope if whatever additional impurities you add function as kind of local uncorrelated potentials, right? The danger is when you get kind of smooth variations in the chemical potential, and if you know the additional atoms that you're putting, if the additional elements that you're putting in influence things on a long scale, then I think you're in trouble, right? And that's not going to work, and it'll very rapidly kill you. But if you're doing things if those atoms actually only affect things very locally, then I think that there's enormous robustness of this phase to local uncorrelated potential disorder. So one hopes that it's the latter effect and not the former. But okay, one has to do the experiment.
Can you density by 10 to the
15? No, it's 10 to the 14th actually. 14th. Yeah.
10 to the 14th, that's easy.
Or you know, even with 2%, when you still get big gaps, I think it goes down to 10 to the 13th or so.
Okay.
So it's not as bad as one electron per site. Then you're done.
People have demonstrated 10 to the 14th.
Yeah, yeah. So it has been done.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.